You're listening to KUOW's The Record, and we're glad you're here. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's Pride Parade brought hundreds of thousands of people downtown yesterday, coming right after the murders at a gay nightclub in Orlando. This year's parade was both joyous and solemn, and KUOW's Carolyn Adolph was there.
The Pride Parade is a time to celebrate the truth about who people are and who they love. And that joy can never go away.
This was last year at Pride.
Right over this way.
This is Barb Brown and Ozzie Wheeler, both of them with rainbow mohawks, a gorgeous motorcycle, and a spirit of wild abandon.
You need to get laid, honey.
And they're handing out rainbow-colored beads.
You got laid at Pride.
I got laid by lesbians at Pride.
My first Pride necklace. And beneath the laughter, seriousness. Because the killings in Orlando are a reminder that people of different sexual or gender identities still aren't safe.
We had to overcome fear to be here this year, but we decided to come out, be loud and be strong.
Because for Brown and Wheeler, there is something worse than the fear of death. Ozzie Wheeler.
It's worse to be closeted. I'd rather come out and risk being slaughtered for who I am than live
in the closet.
In the closet and be ashamed.
Yeah, I'm not ashamed anymore.
Barb Brown.
Never again. Never again be ashamed of who I am.
And then the fun is back.
Gotta get laid twice for that.
Another rainbow necklace. The Pride Parade brings teenagers in from the suburbs, young couples just starting out together, and people carrying signs saying repent. There are also people carrying signs remembering Orlando. One of them is Mark Lewis, who came out as a teenager in the 1970s.
It's an emotional time, but yet things have really changed. And I am so sorry that this had to happen.
He says death has circled this community so often.
I'll never forget the last march on Washington when the AIDS quilt was displayed in its entirety. It was like being at a war memorial. I mean, our community has gone through so much, and it takes tragedies, unfortunately, like Orlando, to really bring us to our feet again.
But this is Seattle, and here the community is large, diverse, and often on its feet, with so much to discuss. Some people are adding new letters to the acronym, LGBTQ plus QIA, and even another A, to try to express all the diversity. Others are saying gender issues are different from issues around sexual orientation. Laura Garman is 15 years old and watching the Pride Parade with her dad. She says there is an important similarity.
Some have been kicked out, some have been rejected by friends and family.
But others have found strength in their support groups.
And sometimes vulnerability is strength. We're accepting who we are, we're just trying to be who we are without judgment.
Garman's father, Steve, nods with approval.
You're cool, Dad.
I try to be.
Then the motorcycles get the signal. And the parade begins. In Seattle, I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
And you're listening to The Record here on KUOW Seattle. Let's turn our attention now to the presidential campaign. Hillary Clinton just held her first campaign appearance with a woman some people would like to be her running mate, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. This is how Warren handles Donald Trump. Or, as she called him, a thin-skinned bully driven by greed and hate.
That's who Donald Trump is, the guy who wants it all for himself. And watch out, because he will crush you into the dirt to get whatever he wants.
Warren told the Cincinnati crowd today that Trump has been cheering Britain's exit from the European Union, even though it's costing small investors billions. For the same reason Trump once called the 2008 housing crash a buying opportunity.
What kind of a man roots for people to lose their jobs, to lose their homes, to lose their life savings? I'll tell you what kind of a man. A small, insecure money grubber who fights for no one but himself.
And then Senator Elizabeth Warren made the case that Hillary Clinton would stand up to Trump and to Wall Street.
Hillary has brains, she has guts, she has thick skin and steady hands, but most of all, she has a good heart, and that's what America needs, and that's why I'm with her. Are you with her?
Hillary Clinton campaigning with Elizabeth Warren today. In response, Donald Trump called Elizabeth Warren a sellout, saying she claims to oppose Wall Street's influence on politics, yet campaigns with Hillary Clinton, who takes tens of millions of dollars from Wall Street interests. We'll cover this more later today on KUOW's All Things Considered this afternoon. And the news continues here in a moment on KUOW's The Record. Thank you for being a part of KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle is changing. It's growing. We get that. We want to show you now how the city is changing by telling you a story. The story of one house. KUOW producers and reporters put this story together. It's part of a project called If These Walls Could Talk. Reporter Liz Jones worked on the project and joins me now. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
Why did you want to tell the story of Seattle through one house?
Well, I have to be honest, this story started out as a very broad idea. We had a team of people who wanted to do a story around race, immigration, and equity. And it was a team of about six women, most of whom are immigrants themselves or children of immigrants. And we came together and brainstormed. Naturally, we start talking about our own neighborhoods and gentrification and our homes and how much things are changing, but then also how things have always been changing, right? So we thought, you know, that's so easy to forget, all the changes that you go through, but our houses remember. If only they could talk, they could tell us about all this change that's gone before and what it looked like. So we thought this might be a way to break down a really big story about change in Seattle into a smaller lens that's more relatable. You know, the houses that we live in, I think it's so personal to so many of us, so relatable to so many of us. The place we grew up, the place where our grandparents live, those are where our stories are at, right?
Yeah, that's right. Are you settled on one house? How did you choose this one home?
Well, we knew we wanted to focus on a place that's been through a lot of change and a lot of tension, and we started looking into places where waves of people have moved through. We started talking about Japanese internment, and we knew we wanted to do a story where that would be a heart of the story. So we looked at the 1940 census records and found all the homes where Japanese families were living right before World War II. We sent letters to a big cluster of these homes, and several of them wrote back, and that's how we found the house that we profiled.
So let's listen to this story. What do you want us to keep in mind while we're hearing this?
I think to think about, you know, yourself, think about your home, your family, your neighborhood, and the place that has in this bigger story of Seattle and change. And I guess just one other tip I would give is I put on my headphones and walked around my neighborhood and listened to this 30-minute podcast of this story. And it really changed the way that I looked at my own neighborhood. I was walking through and thinking about all the families, all the generations that have moved through these places, some that are still there, some that have changed dramatically. And I really related to the place where I live in a little bit different way listening to it.
So what if we get curious about our own home or some other house or home in the city? We have some tools on the website to keep expanding the story, right? Keep changing the story?
Yeah, we really do hope to do more of these, and we're going to need lots more ideas. So you can go online to our website, kuow.org, and there you can find tips about how to research your own house's history or another house that you might be curious about, kind of a how-to guide. And you can also fill out a form to suggest your own home for us to look into or maybe another place that you're curious about, and we'll possibly look into it next.
Okay, let's listen to this story now. Liz Jones, thanks for putting it together, you and your team.
Thank you, Bill.
This house was probably one of the first on the block.
This is the house they were in when Pearl Harbor hit.
Just seemed like the chances of actually living here were pretty slim.
You know, we got married in this house, we had Margot in this house.
There was just so much, like we're all kind of learning and growing and struggling together.
The city we live in changes around us every day, but the history of the city resides in its houses and the people who live in them. Every house has a story, and these stories add up to a bigger picture about Seattle's growth and struggles along the way. A team of KUOW producers and reporters went in search of a house and asked the question, if these walls could talk, what would they say? This is the story of 1643 South King Street.
I'm going to say let's start with that house.
Okay.
And then move down this block.
I'm Liz Jones, and that's my coworker, Isolde Raftery. We're walking down King Street, knocking on doors.
Whoa.
Someone just peeked through the window.
Yeah, so we'll see. People so rarely answer their doors these days, so I'll just leave a letter.
We're asking neighbors for more information about a house on this block, the pale yellow house at 1643, the one with the red metal roof and the bay windows. You can't miss it. It's a pocket of a neighborhood tucked on the edge of Seattle's International District. We were drawn to this area because so much change has happened here. The yellow house on King Street probably wondered, what took you so long? Just weeks before, we left a letter in the mailbox of the King Street house, and the owner replied,
"My daughter Ashley passed along to me your inquiry about the house. I have some information. The Seattle Department of Neighborhoods..."
The more we learned, the more we couldn't believe our luck, that we'd stumbled across this particular house. Man, did it have stories about some pivotal moments in Seattle's history. But first, you should meet the family who lives there now.
I'm Aaron.
And I'm Kate.
And this is our six-month-old daughter, Margot, and we live at 1643 South King Street.
With our two cats, Percy and Mabel.
They've rented this house for about 3 years.
Well, so, yes, this is the foyer.
They're both in their mid-30s, young professionals. Kate's a nurse midwife. Aaron's in public health at the Gates Foundation. But he's currently at home on a year of paid paternity leave. Yeah, I know, right?
This is our dining room.
Theirs is a modern romance. They met online.
I was Aaron's second internet date, and he was my 819th, approximately.
So these are the bedrooms. High ceilings, yeah.
Yes.
We're in baby Margot's nursery.
Come and say hi.
Kate and Aaron entertain Margot.
It's the green maracas.
Yay!
They love this old house and know just a sliver of its history.
We know it was built in 1904, and our landlords purchased it in 2009, and sounds like it was in pretty rough shape.
What would you want to know about the history of this home here?
I mean, I definitely wonder about who lived in here.
It's kind of neat to picture a whole family in here or a whole community of people, and I don't know, just thinking that there is that shared connection with people in the past.
Okay, so Patrick Riley, he's living at 1643 King Street. He owns his house free and clear.
Patrick Riley, he's our guy. He and his wife, Nellie, were the original owners of King Street House back when it was built in 1904.
1.5-story frame cottage, 23 by 26.5, $1,050.
This is Mary Kircher Roddy. She's a genealogy whiz and helped us track down lots of old documents. We're in her living room, and she's squinting at her laptop screen.
I have to zoom in and find it. 1900 census.
The Rileys moved into this house smack in the middle of Seattle's first boom. The city's population would more than triple during this decade.
A lot of people that had come because of the gold rush in Alaska.
Patrick Riley was a son of Irish immigrants. With Nellie, he moved from the Midwest to Seattle, probably in search of opportunity. They had one child, a daughter named Hazel.
Hazel Mae Riley is 5 years old. She was born in November of 1894.
The home on King Street sat on a hill, almost alone, in the wooded outskirts of downtown. The Riley family lived there about 20 years. And from their front porch, they would have watched the city grow up. Smith Tower is built, streetcar lines expand, the seawall project transforms the waterfront. Neighborhoods begin to take shape, and soon, on the Riley's block...
There are people in this place from all over. So we get Kentucky, England, Ohio, Florida, Washington, England, Ireland, Illinois...
Most are blue-collar workers.
Here's a gold miner, a helper in a foundry, laborer in a coal bunker, boiler maker.
Patrick had several jobs, a cigar maker, a prospector in Alaska, horse tender at the brewery. He was secretary of his union, the United Brewery Workmen, and sometimes he got in heated exchanges with management. He died tragically at age 50.
And I did find one article. You probably already have the article about the accident from the Seattle Times.
We took that article and everything we learned about the Rileys back to King Street House to the current renters, Kate and Aaron Zeichner.
This is the article in the Seattle Times.
That's producer Amina Alsadi. She did a lot of digging on the Rileys.
Wow. We found, yeah.
One, you should read the headline there.
Speeding machine deals death, darts on.
Such an old-fashioned word.
Coined the term hit and run, I guess.
Yeah, it's a funny, old-timey headline from 1915. But sadly, it was progress that killed Riley. An automobile driving 40 miles per hour. It's a hit and run, just a couple of blocks away.
What did it say there?
I was just seeing that he had just left a DeCaro grocery store that was at 18th and Jackson.
Riley was walking home from the grocery store.
And in this article, they said that he worked at the Old Seattle Brewing Company. Yeah. And that eventually became Rainier Brewery. So this family was really a part of early Seattle and the rise of early Seattle.
From the beginning, there was Rainier, brewed in Seattle in 1878 as it is today, proud of its rich heritage of 100 years and looking not to the past, but to the future.
The Zeichners ask more about Hazel Riley, since they've got a daughter here too now, Margot. Turns out they almost had the same name, too.
Hazel was on our list.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We tell them about Hazel's marriage. The Rileys had added a second house on the property. It's still here, by the way. And Hazel ends up marrying a boarder.
Married a tenant who was living in the little cottage?
The back house here.
The back house. Okay. Yeah. Which was actually pretty common. Back then, you just married people in your neighborhood.
Yeah. It's before Match.com.
Yeah. So it wasn't that unusual that she would marry her tenant, but it's kind of cute.
Hazel worked at a candy store and eventually became president of her union, the Candy Workers Local 371. Her husband, Benjamin, worked at the shipyard. They never had children, and Hazel's mother, Nellie, never remarried. What's left of them are grave markers at a cemetery just north of Seattle, and pieces of their story, and the little yellow cottage they once owned on King Street. After the Rileys, a next wave of immigrants arrive, and by the eve of World War II, Japanese-American families are living up and down the block in a neighborhood that became known as Japantown.
Are you Jay Shinji?
Hi!
That's my coworker, Ruby DeLuna. She's meeting with Jay Shoji. Jay's dad used to live in this house on King Street.
Yep, it's the second one from the corner, I believe, with the red roof there.
Jay's never been inside until today.
Okay.
Right.
Ready?
Set in. Sure.
All right.
The current renters, Kate and Aaron Zeichner, are expecting us.
Hi.
Hello. Hi, guys. Come on. She's off, or?
That'd be great.
It's fine. Yeah.
Jay's been around this neighborhood most of his life. He still goes to St. Peter's Church down the street. His grandfather was the minister there. In fact, he was the only non-white Episcopal minister in Seattle until the mid-1930s. Jay's grandmother held a prestigious title in Japanese flower arrangement. They moved into the home on King Street around 1939.
Sitting room.
Okay.
Kate and Aaron show him around.
Here's the other bedroom.
They peek in the small bedrooms where his dad and three siblings probably slept.
Here's what is now.
I like the subway tile on it.
The kitchen prompts a story that Jay's dad told for years. It's about the Depression and some cantaloupe saved in the icebox, a rare treat.
And my dad was like saving this piece for himself. And one of the nosy church ladies who came over to bother my grandmother was sitting in the kitchen. He comes in the back door, and he sees that she's eating his piece of cantaloupe, and he gets pissed. Right? So I know that one happened here, and there's another story.
All Jay has to go on are a few of these stories handed down to him. The family only lived here a short time before their quiet life came crashing down.
I mean, it was a Sunday, so they would have been in church.
1234, this is KJU in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Not sure that everybody quite understood the implications of what was going to happen.
We have witnessed this morning the severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes, undoubtedly Japanese.
Jay's dad is 16 years old, a junior at Garfield High School. He played drums in the band.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry.
Japanese Americans on the west coast are forced out of their homes and moved to internment camps.
I certainly know they went from here to Camp Harmony. And it was just this big muddy pit that they had to go figure out. They lived in the stables, right, where the horses were.
Camp Harmony is now the state fairground. From there, they moved to the Minidoka camp in Idaho. Internment was rough on everyone, but especially on Jay's aunt Florence. She was disabled from an early childhood illness, paralyzed on one side. But at home on King Street, she'd been improving.
Before the war, they got her to a place where she was able to change herself, feed herself, and that all went away when they went to camp.
Decades later, Jay's father would tell Congress about his family's experience at camp. Jay flips through the pages of his dad's testimony.
Well, there's the one that he explains what happens to my aunt. And I think that's... here it is.
Okay.
So my sister Florence was 13 years old when she had to leave Seattle with the rest
of her. Well, she had to be confined to one portion of our room in this shack that we had now called our home.
This is recorded testimony of Jay's dad, the late Samuel Shoji.
She regressed and began having grand mal seizures and finally had to be admitted to the Idaho State Hospital where she died. Being isolated from her parents...
Yeah, I know that that's something Dad said, that camp killed Auntie Florence, right? And he has no doubt about that.
Internment derailed and redirected life for the Shoji family, just as it did for more than 7,000 people around Seattle who were sent to the camps. King Street and the neighborhood around Japantown was forever changed.
Everybody who left, it wasn't everybody who came back.
The Shojis did return to Seattle, but the King Street house was no longer theirs. They landed in public housing. Other families scattered to new parts of the city, but their closeness lasted generations.
I mean, in fact, growing up, my mom and dad would sit at the table and talk about somebody getting married or somebody passing away or somebody, and they would actually refer to them by, oh, you know, that family that lived over in Block 7. That's how you knew who families were 20 years after the war, 30 years after the war. You knew that, oh yeah, you remember those people, they were over in, you know, Block 11.
Jay's father, Samuel Shoji, became a social worker, a community activist, and a crusader for equality. He left a mark on Seattle. And at a time when many were reluctant to speak out against internment, Sam Shoji took a stand.
Shoji, Seattle.
My name is Sam Shoji. I'm 56 years old, married, and I have two children. I was 16 years old when the evacuation occurred, and I spent 13 months in Puyallup and Minidoka.
In 1976, President Gerald Ford proclaimed the internment was a national mistake. There's a current that runs through this house of people standing up for a cause. The Rileys opened that door as union leaders. Sam Shoji pushed that door wide open. The next few decades would raise the roof as the house turned from a single-family residence to a shared home for activists, artists, and self-described weirdos. Their run lasted about 35 years. They called it the King Street Collective.
So, yeah, you come up the stairs. There's a bunch of
crap on the porch. Whose crap is this? Shouldn't this have been moved already? It's not mine. It's not mine. It's not anyone's. Why is it here? You know. Through the front door, you can see books. It was just floor to ceiling, wall to wall books in that first little. I'm Ronnie Tartlett. I'm 41, and I lived at the King Street Collective from 1999 till 2009.
The one on the left.
Now she lives in the San Juan Islands, just a few hours north of Seattle.
Hi, I'm Ronnie.
Hi, Ronnie.
Hey.
She arranged for us to meet at her friend's place. It's a cluster of cottages in the woods. We admire the gardens, the chickens, the geese in the pond. It's a collective kind of living, but far more pastoral than King Street, where Ronnie lived for a decade.
Yeah, I was definitely kind of like the grandpa of the house. People would joke, like, you're going to be here forever. And I was like, maybe.
Ronnie moved into King Street after a group of so-called manarchists moved out. She and her friend Ronica wanted to usher in a new scene.
You know, like a queer, multiracial activist house or something like that.
Ronnie gave it a fresh coat of paint.
So the middle room, I got everyone to let me paint it orange. I don't know how everyone else liked it, but I loved the, like, bright orange, and then the silver trim, it was very bright. During all the time I lived there, there were between 6 and maybe 8 people living there all together. Everyone paid $166.66 a month, which times 6 is what it was, I can't remember.
It's $1,000, minus 4 pennies.
It was definitely a shifting group. Some people would stay for years, and some people would stay for, like, a year or maybe 6 months.
What they all had in common was social activism, for different causes, but with similar dedication.
But yeah, and there had been Books to Prisoners for a long time, and Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites, which still exists, and Jewish Voice for Peace, the Seattle chapter. There's also an organization called Tadaima, which was like a...
Others focused on farm workers, Filipino politics, or Japanese Americans. The list goes on. King Street was also a lifeline for several squat houses in the neighborhood, or for people who were between housing. They'd come to use the phone.
So people would get their mail and take a shower and, you know, maybe do some cooking and stuff.
Cooking in a kitchen the size of a closet.
The worst designed kitchen you can imagine. It was often high comedy because you'd have like 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people in there trying to do stuff, and you're just like butt to butt and elbow to elbow, and like it was ridiculous.
Sometimes they had parties for queer or trans people to meet each other and be themselves. Like 150 people would come. And when things got heavy in the house, they had a release valve.
We had our magic mic set up in there, which was a very important feature of the house.
What's a magic mic?
It's a karaoke, a home karaoke system. Sometimes someone would just need to work something out. Like, there's something very healing about it. There can be.
I don't know what you're saying.
I know. What's your go-to karaoke song?
I have a million songs. I mean, Just a Gigolo by David Lee Roth was, I think, my first one.
In 1999, some new groups found their voice at King Street on the eve of the WTO riots.
The Indie Media Collective, you know, IMC, that actually formed at our house by someone who was living there.
It's a citizen journalist network that later spread across the globe.
And then also the Infernal Noise Brigade, that included a lot of people who lived at the house, and their kind of debut was around the WTO events. Doing some work on a zine that was like, here's Seattle, like for people coming, because, you know, the idea was definitely like a lot of people are gonna come, like, and at that time we had no idea that it would be as big as it was. King Street was what it was for so long. It had been a collective for 35 years. There was something very stable and lasting seeming about that house. And then, like, we literally woke up one day and there was a for sale sign being, like, pounded into the front yard. And we're like, what the f-? So it turned into, like, if we were not able to buy the house, this is just done.
Ronnie and others scrambled together a cash offer, but no luck. It was time to say goodbye.
You know, we had, of course, like a really big party, King Street closing party, and it was very bittersweet and, like, you know, a lot of people came. But it just was, like, there's just a lot of emotion, like, among even, like, it kind of surprised me even among a lot of people who never lived there, but were just like, this is where I first, like, realized that it was okay to be queer. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I remember you were coming around. I'd be like, oh, that closeted girl, dude, you know, whatever, whatever it may be.
They were moving out of the house, but it was more like closing down an institution.
It was like a community center, kind of like a community center that's now closed. I hope other ones turn up because people really need this. But it just seems hard. It seems hard for there to be those, like, reliable, stable spaces in town. And King Street really felt like that for a lot of people. So it's definitely a loss.
Do you ever drive by the house just to see how it's doing?
No, I have not been on the street. Like, I avoid.
You intentionally avoid it?
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't. I mean, probably they repainted. Probably it looks really different. I'm sure they took out all the raspberries and all the, you know, the wacky garden that we had going. Like, I'm sure it looks completely different, and it would feel really painful to me to just see, like, a neat, you know, single family home there. So I just feel incredibly grateful to have had that place to be in and to grow and be a weirdo and, like, create with really amazing other people.
So many people passed through the King Street Collective. Some fell in love there and started families together. Others went on to work in city government, teach college, run an organic farm. They've disbanded, but Ronnie says they still keep in touch a lot.
What are you going to put on this pizza?
I think we're going to do a couple of margaritas and then a couple rosas, they're called.
Back now, one last time at King Street House with the current renters, Kate and Aaron Zeichner, and baby Margot. The house still shows original charms, leaded glass windows, secret pocket doors, and now a modern side, especially in the spacious new kitchen with two ovens and three sinks.
Rosemary, chopped pistachios, red onions.
Kate and Aaron feel lucky to live here.
You know, I've lived a lot of different places in my life. Aaron has too, and I feel like this is the first place that I've really, really wanted to live in. You know, we got married in this house, we had Margot in this house, so this was the beginning of a lot of things for our family.
In the timeline of this house, that's the note they'd want to pass on. This place is special to them. And it's taken on kind of a whole new meaning now that they know all this history.
I mean, I'm sure that I'll be thinking about it day to day, just all the names and occupations and just like what people...
They'll think about how their block has changed since the Rileys first settled here to when the Shoji family was forced out.
It's hard to walk around this neighborhood and not feel like a sense of sadness and think about it. All the lives that were disrupted here.
And they'll imagine all the activists who shared this place.
When we sit on the porch, I'll think about how we're a little family of three, and, you know, there was once a big group of people that were the King Street house.
The neighborhood is still pretty mixed. Families, seniors, immigrants, working class, and more newcomers, too.
Gentrifying, definitely, and I guess we're part of that.
From the porch, to the kitchen, to the nursery, the Zeichners say the home feels different to them now.
Knowing all this history of people that have lived here before, it feels less ours, but not in a bad way. Yeah, it just feels like this is more of a shared space than it ever felt like before. I mean, it's pretty humbling, really, when you hear about everything that
people have gone through living in this house and everything that has happened in these walls.
This story was produced by KUOW Public Radio. The team includes Liz Jones, Ruby DeLuna, Amina Alsadi, Isolde Raftery, and me, Kate Walters. It was edited by Carol Smith, with sound design by Whitney Henry Lester. This story included music by Lulatone. You can find the full credits on our website at kuow.org.
Margo, this is so interesting. There is a kid named Hazel who lived here, Margo.
Does your house have a story to tell? We'd love to hear from you. Go to KUOW.org for tips on how to do your own house history and share your story with us. Coming up on KUOW's The Record, why did Seattle lose this one to Silicon Valley? Why shouldn't Seattle lose sometimes to Silicon Valley? We'll talk about that in a moment. First of all, at one time, a network of wetlands and marshes surrounded southern Oregon's upper Klamath Lake. These were the hunting and gathering grounds of Native Americans. One of their subsistence foods was a water lily, an abundant water lily they called the Wokus. But then came dam building, and now these fertile wetlands were used for agriculture. The Wokus began to disappear. Reporter Jess Burns of our EarthFix team says there's an effort underway to bring the plant back.
The marsh is alive with the chatter of hundreds of birds. They get more agitated as Blake Eldridge steers his small boat near a tangle of head-high vegetation on the shore. Just a decade back, this place was a different world.
There's nothing out here. I mean, it's just open pasture. And now we see cattails coming up and willows, some tules, you know, it's really coming around.
Eldridge works for the Nature Conservancy, which owns this property where the Williamson River flows into Upper Klamath Lake. It was all farmland until the group blew up the dikes, letting the lake flood in and restore the original wetland. The spire-like tules and willows came in naturally, but there's one native water plant that's conspicuously missing, the Wokus.
For us particularly, it's the Upper Klamath Marsh. It was 10,000 acres of Wokus. It was said that a woman could gather her height in a pile in a day.
That's changed, says Perry Choktoot Jr., director of the Cultural and Heritage Department of the Klamath Tribes. As the wetlands were drained, the lily pads vanished, and the tribes lost a valuable resource. Seeds from the Wokus yielded a yellow dye for their baskets. Those seeds also provided a major food staple, flour.
It's like farina and oatmeal had a baby called Wokus.
The tribes would like to add Wokus back to their diet. Reintroducing the pond lily should also create habitat for endangered fish species, says the tribe's ecosystems restoration scientist, Megan Skinner.
Wokus provides a lot of structure and habitat for native species. In particular, you know, larval and juvenile suckers out in the lake need cover from predation.
This is part of the reason the Nature Conservancy is reestablishing Wokus in the Williamson Delta Marsh. The lily isn't moving in naturally, so Eldridge and a small crew are giving it a helping hand.
We're looking, usually trying to target places with relatively good cover from wind and a nice soft substrate. If you saw where we had harvested these from, it's in a roadside ditch.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife's Christy Adelsberger is working with Eldridge to transplant clusters of Wokus throughout the marsh. She stands chest deep in the mucky water, wearing a bright blue dry suit that's a little too big, and mirrored neon orange sunglasses.
Christy, do you want me to take your sunglasses?
No way.
She takes a deep breath and disappears underwater, sunglasses and all, pulling a floating Wokus with her. Suddenly, Adelsberger's feet shoot up to the surface, thrashing at the water, keeping her top half under. She pins the pineapple-sized bulb to the bottom with a large rebar staple.
Success.
Good job.
The crew calls this awkward dry suit ballet the Wokus Dance.
It's not pretty. You know, a bunch of flailing about,
This is the third year the Nature Conservancy has transplanted Wokus into the marsh shallows. Some clusters seem to be thriving, sending numerous yellow ball-shaped flowers to the surface. Others haven't made it, says Eldridge.
I probably wouldn't be happy until all of the open water in this part would be Wokus. But I probably won't see that in my lifetime.
Still, there's been enough success that Eldridge thinks it's worthwhile to keep going, making the Wokus Dance an annual event. I'm Jess Burns reporting from Upper Klamath Lake.
And you're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. In the news today, an abortion rights group says the Supreme Court has sent a message that politicians cannot use deceptive means to shut down abortion clinics.
After years of fighting heartless, anti-choice politicians who would seemingly stop at nothing to put abortion out of reach, I want everybody to understand you don't mess with Texas women.
That is the founder of the Whole Woman's Health Center reacting today to the Supreme Court ruling striking down Texas abortion regulations that are similar to those in several states. The rules require doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, and the court disagreed with the claim by Texas that those rules were there to protect women's health. Now, here in Washington State, we don't have that rule. We don't require abortion doctors to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. We also don't require that an abortion clinic meet the same standards as an ambulatory surgical center. Those are the rules Texas and other states have. In Olympia today, in fact, Washington's Attorney General Bob Ferguson said the Supreme Court made the right decision. Today on KUOW, we're going to show you how significant that ruling could be. That's coming up on KUOW's All Things Considered this afternoon. KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle loses out to Silicon Valley again. But is that a bad thing? Todd Bishop from the Seattle-based tech news site GeekWire. Welcome back, Todd.
Thanks, Bill. And may I request that song to play whenever I walk into a room?
Yeah, like when you come up to bat.
Yes.
Everybody, each bat hitter has their own.
Yeah, that's my new theme.
Plate music, and that's Todd Bishop's theme. So we'll remember that. We'll make a note. What did we lose to Silicon Valley, Todd?
A company called Twilio, and folks who were following the news last week will remember that this was the first U.S.-backed IPO of 2016. They went public. This is a company that provides services for other companies to use in their apps. So its customers include Uber and Nordstrom and others. They build things like notifications and voice calling into their apps using Twilio's technology. The big news here was that Twilio was started in Seattle quite a while ago, and they ended up moving to San Francisco for personal reasons of the founder. But it's part of this larger trend of Seattle versus Silicon Valley and what's best for startups in those respective regions.
You say for personal reasons. Are you suggesting that maybe it wasn't just personal reasons, but there's also that startup environment you're talking about?
Certainly, the startup environment here was not enough to overcome those personal reasons.
There you go.
For the founder of Twilio, Jeff Lawson, to stay. His wife got a fellowship in San Francisco, so an admirable move by him to move his entire company down there for her. But there have been other examples of this as well. Box is another example, founded by two sons of Mercer Island, Washington, who ended up moving to Silicon Valley to start that. And that also went public in a very successful IPO. So this is a trend. Now, there are counter trends. Tableau Software started at Stanford University, moved up here, still based in Fremont. So it's just part of the natural ebb and flow. But for the most part, we've seen companies go out of Seattle to San Francisco, and that can be a troubling trend.
Why do companies go from Seattle to San Francisco area?
Primarily access to investors, which is an Achilles heel for the Seattle market. There's a much larger pool of angel investors to initially get companies off the ground, of venture capitalists to provide those second and third rounds of funding that can really get companies to those next stages of growth. And so those are on Sand Hill Road, or they're in San Francisco in the Bay Area. And so that is a struggle. There are, of course, investors here, but they are not as numerous.
Why are they not as numerous?
It's just not as much of as big of a market. You've also seen some of the large tech employees leave places like Amazon and not necessarily become as active as investors. They might become more philanthropic or do other things with their money, but they're not, in large part, becoming angel investors themselves.
So as you said, part of that is probably a numbers game. There's not as much, so therefore there's not as much. Or, you know, but is there also, do you think there's a cultural difference?
To some extent there is. And of course, there are some folks in Seattle who would say, well, we don't want that San Francisco culture. Maybe this is a good thing that these companies are moving out. I'm preempting a possible argument by you, Bill, because I know we've talked about this in the past.
Yes.
That said, you know, this is, in general, a good thing for the economy when companies are growing and expanding here and creating jobs here, and theoretically, at least, lifting up people into greater echelons of income.
I read a piece at GeekWire that was written by a co-founder, one of these Mercer Island youths who co-founded Box, and he was describing why he left. And, of course, I'm not much in the tech world. I'm not catching all of his references. But the tone was in his world, it was so, it was a loss that Seattle is not like Silicon Valley. And then I read the comments. Of course, these are GeekWire reader comments, right? And there, people really get that. Oh, thank you. Yes, he's saying important things about how what we lack here. And not being from the tech world, I was thinking it is very natural to not want to lose anything. We hate to lose stuff. So if you hear that we're losing things, we're losing, and it's a lot of money. It's billions of dollars, right?
And many jobs.
And many, many jobs go there instead of here. But what about, what do you do with this idea that is mo' money, mo' better all the time?
Hopefully. And it was funny. There was a great story on KUOW last week that looked at the housing trends, and it was almost hoping for a bust in the tech economy to lower housing prices. And that felt a little bit to me like hoping for an airline crash to bring down airfare. So I think there are ways to add jobs, add companies, keep them here, and at the same time do other things like raise the minimum wage, make housing more affordable to address the root of the problem, which is not the economic boom. It's the other stuff that we need to fix.
No good reason to lose another $2 billion startup.
Absolutely not. Not with all the jobs that it brings.
Todd Bishop from the Seattle-based tech news site GeekWire. Thanks for joining us as always, Todd.
Thank you, Bill.
Good to see you. Seattle Mariners are better this year than last. How much better? You want to know, Todd, how much better?
Yes, yes.
65 days better, I say. Because last season, it only took 25 days for the Mariners manager to get thrown out of the game for protesting a call. It was April 26th. The Mariners were losing again. They were about to be tied for last place, and that's typically when a manager does something drastic.
Well, now he's giving it to the home plate.
He's all
umpire.
Over Sean Barber. He may not last, and he's gone. He was looking for that one.
Yeah, he was looking for it. Lloyd McClendon purposefully got himself ejected because that's how you fire up a struggling team. Well, yesterday, the Mariners were losing again, as they've been doing more lately. New Seattle manager Scott Servais, you know what to do.
He's thrown Scott Servais out. First time Scott Servais has been thrown out of a ball game.
First time he's been thrown out of a ball game, and it didn't happen until late June this time, 90 days into the season. That's a big 65-day improvement, Todd.
Bring back Sweet Lou, please.
He was famous.
Yeah.
He would throw his hat. He would throw the umpire's hat.
The bases.
Yeah, the bases. So if it's not working, manager Scott Servais, next time, throw your hat. Kick dirt on the umpire's shoes.
I love it. He's blowing a gasket. That's awesome.
Everybody's getting a piece.
I love it. A little hustle, too.
Do you think he cares?
Absolutely.
I bet he does. He knows how important this is.
Yeah, that's how much the manager cares when he loses his stuff. That was Seattle's manager losing it last year. We'll see how this year's manager can hold it together. Todd, good to see you.
Thanks, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record.